Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome to Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9, tonight with Alan and Kafam. We have showcased a number of Joy 94.9 presenters of multicultural background. Tonight, on the hot seat, is our very own Orange Ribbon presenter, Hugh. It's a chance to find out who Hugh is all about. Well, for all his Stalker fans, this is going to be a treat. Another interesting chat coming up on Orange Ribbon, so stay with us for the next hour on Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Orange Ribbon, tonight with Kafam and me, Alan. And just to point out to our listeners, particularly if you keep an eye on the program blog, which you can get access to from joy.org.au under Orange Ribbon, we did have a guest was on the blog. Tony Pittman was to be our guest tonight. Unfortunately, Tony has taken ill and at last minute is not able to come in. So we've decided to take a different tack tonight, and we're going to be talking to somebody who's very familiar to Orange Ribbon listeners, namely Hugh. So we also say hello to Hugh as well.
I don't know if I want to sit this side of the mic.
So what does it feel like to be on the other side
of
the mic?
I know. Ask me at the end.
Well, we'll ask you to start off with about that music, because you were telling us in the break that apparently there's a bit of a story associated with it, albeit being very faint, we should point out, because the levels on that CD were very, very low.
And yeah, it was weird, wasn't it? It's actually, the singer is Elke Brooks, who's an English singer, and when I broke up with my first partner, this was the song I played every day.
Roughly how old were you when this occurred?
Oh, I was late 20s.
Mm-hmm. And so, how long did it take for you to recover?
I don't know. I think I must have listened to this song about a million times.
Maybe that's why it's got a soft level now, because you've played it so much.
That's it.
Now, a little bit of background, Hugh. Where did you grow up?
Well, obviously, I come from Scotland. I mean,
do you really?
Yeah, yeah. I was born in a village just outside Edinburgh. The name of the village is Addie Brown Hill.
Say again?
Addie Brown Hill.
Addie Brown Hill.
Yes. It's a very, very small village. Even to this day, it's still a very small village. It doesn't have any shops. It doesn't have a pub. It doesn't have anything, just some houses. So, very, very small. It's about 15 minutes outside Edinburgh, I suppose. So it's near the city, and if it was in Australia, it'd be a suburb of Melbourne, for example. But because it's Scotland, it's in the country, so it's very...
I guess geographically, that's something that we have a little difficulty in coming to grips with here, where we're used to cities like Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and so on being such sprawling cities, mm-hmm. where you can go 30, 40 kilometres or more out of the city and you're still in suburban CBD, or not CBD, suburban city. Mm. Whereas Edinburgh, what's the population of Edinburgh, roughly?
I would say roughly 2 million. Maybe.
Oh, so it's about half the size of Melbourne. Mm. And yet, even if Melbourne was half the size that it is now, you could still go 15 minutes out from the CBD and you'd still be in the suburbs.
It's a small city, Edinburgh, and when you do travel out, especially where I was born and where I was brought up, because I was brought up in another village called Blackburn, the same as the Blackburn in Victoria.
Yes.
And it is in the country. Once you leave the city, your fields and trees, and that's all you see for the next 15, 20 minutes, you see. So
is, and I've not been to Edinburgh, I've been to the UK, but I've never been to Edinburgh. So is the structure of Edinburgh much more compact in the sense that people live, you don't have large backyards, maybe you live in high and multi-story, well, I can't imagine living in high rise so much like Hong Kong or Singapore or Taipei or something like that.
No. You've got Victorian Edinburgh, you've got Jordan Edinburgh. When I lived there, I lived in an apartment. My first apartment, for example, was Victorian. It goes up about four levels, mostly in Edinburgh, four or five levels is as high as you would go, probably. On the outskirts of Edinburgh, you have what you call commission houses. They're sort of high-rise, but very few of them. Edinburgh is a very old city, and the council go to great lengths to keep it looking very, very old. So even any new buildings that are built have to be built in an old style. So it costs a lot more money to build, obviously. Mm-hmm. And if you own an apartment, for example, you have to get permission to, if you want to change the windows or do anything on the outside of the building. Before I left Edinburgh, I lived in a new area in the city that was built up, and you weren't allowed to even put washing outside. Do you see? You couldn't do anything.
Does the sun come out at all in Scotland?
It's just the Edinburgh Council are very protective of the city because it's very old, and you rely on tourists, and there's millions of tourists every year, so they want to keep it looking old and beautiful. So
you lived out at this little place that's name escapes me again.
Yeah, I was Adderbrown Hill is where I was born.
Were you a gay boy there, or did that happen later after you moved?
I actually was brought up in Blackburn.
Oh, okay.
But
and is it a small village as well?
It was then. It's maybe double the size now, but it's still a village, really.
In other words, instead of 20, there's 40 people.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. was I gay there? I suppose I was at the end, yeah. But I left very early. As soon as I could leave, I left and went and to the city to live, big Edinburgh city.
Well, you're on Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9. I'm with our guest tonight, Hugh, and when we come back, we talk about being the only gay in the village.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Orange Ribbon, Joy 94.9's multicultural program, and our guest tonight, Hugh, you chose that song. What was any special significance for that song?
I just liked that song. It was one of the songs I grew up with, I suppose, and Alison Moye, who was...
All Cried Out.
Yeah, I just loved her as a singer when she first came out, and when I eventually lived in Edinburgh, back to Edinburgh after being away for years and years and years, and she was huge in the UK. I listened to her albums all the time. All the time.
It's a common theme. Now, talking about growing up as the gay in the village, what was that like for you? You know, because you didn't have any gay contact with any other people.
And in which village are we talking about?
Right.
Because you were in a few, so you were telling us in the break.
Well, when I was brought up in Blackburn, and I suppose really I didn't realise or didn't want to think I was gay until I was, I would say, early 20s. And I was still living in Blackburn at that point. So it was something that you just couldn't talk about, you couldn't do anything about, because there was nothing there for anyone who's gay. There's no bars, there's nothing. So you
knew no gay people
as
well.
That's right, yeah.
But surely when you were going through puberty and, you know, all the hormones are raging, and there are other men around, you would have, you know, had feelings.
You have feelings, but you can't do anything about it because you're living in a village. You went to school in the next village, and very homophobic villages as well at that time, I suppose. So there's not a lot you could do.
So you were saying in the break to us that you've moved to a few places, and I think you ended up where? Aberdeen, where you first went to a gay bar?
Before Aberdeen, I actually moved to Shetland Isles.
Shetland Islands. Isn't it cold there, isn't it?
It's freezing cold, yeah.
Yeah.
But before we move to the Shetland, I'm curious because you have a niece who is a lesbian.
Yes.
Is she in Black Rock?
Blackburn.
No,
actually, she lives in Livingston, which is about a 15-minute drive. I suppose Livingston's a town, not a village. And, she lives there, but they still have problems. They still, all the gay people who, in that town, maybe go to a straight bar, because they don't have gay bars there. And people do, sometimes object to it. But Shelley, who's my niece...
who we had on the program recorded when you were back there.
That's correct.
In January, February.
She doesn't see too many problems, but every now and again you do get some homophobic people who go into the bar and object to all these gays being in the bar. And it's a little bit what Alan said in Aberdeen, when I lived in Aberdeen in the north of Scotland. This is quite a long time ago, and it was called a discotheque then, not a club.
Yeah.
Give my age away then. And we had a bar on a Friday night, and that was all. And it was in a seedy part of Aberdeen. You had to walk into this really seedy part of Aberdeen. And it was a room above the most homophobic bar you've ever seen in your life, but thank God it had a separate entrance to it, and you went up to this bar upstairs, and they had a gay disco every Friday. So
it's like you guys hire out a place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And were the owners of the pub aware of what's going upstairs?
Oh, of course, of course. I mean, how could you hide 100 gays
raging queens congregating every Friday night?
No, they were very aware, but it was actually a group of people in Aberdeen who were involved with the gay switchboard up there. And they got together and they started this disco every Friday. And it was called Daisies.
And, Daisies, as in the flower.
That's it. And they were really, really good. And for somebody like myself, when I first moved to Aberdeen and went to this bar, someone would come up and recognize that you're a stranger and say, oh, are you living here or are you just a tourist? And I was living there, and I said, I'm living here now. And they'd say, oh, let me introduce you. And they introduced me to everybody who was involved with the organization of this discotheque. And I got to know so many people and made a lot of good friends up there, so I had a great time.
So it'd be like more like a community club than a discotheque, wouldn't it? You could almost call
it. It was a little bit like that, yes. You walked in and you knew everyone. You knew everyone, and you met a lot of different people. So you felt at home. So you went there and you just felt comfortable, and you could go and have a few drinks, have a dance, you know, enjoy yourself, and maybe meet someone, you know, maybe.
I wanted to move back to the Shetland Islands.
The Shetland Islands.
Yes,
yeah.
Because why did you go to the Shetlands? Was it for work or for other reasons?
It was for work originally. I'm involved in management in hotels at that time, and the assistant manager and his wife were friends of mine. I was the best man at their wedding, and they actually went up there. And it was during the oil boom when they were building Sullivan Oil Terminal in Shetland for the North Sea oil.
North Sea oil, right.
And this hotel was being built, and it was going to be for all the executives of BP and all the different companies that were involved with the construction of Sullivan. And they asked me if I would go up there and help them by being the banquet and restaurant manager. And
so by this time, you already were trained in this field?
Yeah, I was. And I'd worked with Billy, who was the assistant manager. Anyway, I agreed to go up. I really didn't know what I was going to, because I'd never been to Shetland. And I didn't realise it was such a... It's a big island, but it's not really that big. It's like 100 miles long or something, but that's it. And there's nothing there. And
geographically, it's located where? North of the main part of Scotland?
Yes, roughly. It's in the North Sea, north of Scotland.
North of Scotland.
It's actually nearer Norway than Scotland.
Really?
Yeah. So you can imagine how cold it is up there.
It
is absolutely freezing. Snow, the first New Year, the snow was up to our waist.
Goodness.
In the village. And I don't exaggerate. And the village was sort of in two parts, and the snow drifted into the middle of the village, so the village was cut in half, basically. And the snow was so deep, we couldn't get between the two halves of the village. It was cold, but there was nothing there either. And when I first arrived there to work in this hotel and help to open this hotel, there was no roof on the hotel.
So all this, you know, the cold air would have got into the hotel.
Of course.
But what do you mean, no roof on
it? Well, they were still building it.
Oh.
But they didn't tell me this when I went there. And so I literally helped to open this. And all the furniture came from Sweden. And we actually, it all came flat pack. So we had to build
the screwdrivers out.
So it's a bit like IKEA.
Well, no, it wasn't IKEA,
but similar.
So it was interesting, and the first 6 months were probably the hardest part. You know, living on an island where you didn't have any street lights. The television worked sometimes. And when the television didn't work, the radio didn't work either. So
we're talking about when, the 70s or the 80s? Roughly
80s, yeah.
No, it was in the 80s. Mm. So did you get... How long were you on the islands for?
I actually stayed for 3.5 years.
So how often did you get off the... off the island, I mean.
I was there for 6 months, and then I came off for a week, purely because, you know, I was getting to the point of thinking, oh, God, I have to go off this island. But every 6 months or so, we'd get off the island, and we had air crews that stayed in the hotel, and they flew the construction workers up and down. So there's 3 flights every morning went to Glasgow, and 3 flights came back from Glasgow every day. And we got to know all the pilots because I was a manager in the hotel, and I used to hitch free lifts to Glasgow on the flight and then get back on the flight in the afternoon, come back up. So I'd go shopping in Glasgow on my day off. So it was like a two-hour flight to Glasgow and then two-hour flight back in the afternoon. And if there was no seats on the plane for me to sit on, I'd sit between the two pilots on the jump seat. So it was quite good.
So there were no gay clubs, one presumes, on the island?
There was nothing gay on the island. It's the most homophobic place. It was me.
And probably a few others that you didn't know of.
Probably. But I actually met my first partner there.
Oh, off an oil rig or something?
No. He was a chef in the hotel.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Did your gaydar go off when you saw him? Is that how it happened?
Well, I suppose something must have happened.
Ding,
yeah.
Ding, ding, ding.
And him and I met each other in Shetland, of all the places in the world to meet somebody. And both of us stayed for 3.5 years. We broke up just before we left the island. And then he went to Holland, to Amsterdam, to live. And he still lives there, actually. And I went to Aberdeen. So, but it was interesting.
Tell us about the courtship. How did it happen? Because, you know, obviously you didn't know any gay people on, and there just happened to be the chef there.
Yeah.
Hanky-panky in the kitchen or something.
Because Shetland, it was very expensive to live on Shetland. You couldn't rent a property to live in because of the oil boom there. So the hotel provided accommodation for us. And the assistant manager and his wife had a house at the back of the hotel and actually shared their house until the hotel opened. And Gordon lived in the house next door with the head chef. And we all used to get together for dinner at night, and or some nights, and have dinner and a few glasses of wine. And one night, him and I were left on our own, and one thing led to another, and that was it.
That's not detail enough.
That's as much detail as you get.
You're not tonight. And when we come back, we'll pump him for more information.
Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
White a shade of pale.
Procol Harum is the original one, and I can remember back, but that's not Procol Harum.
No, that's a good Scottish singer, Annie Lennox.
Annie Lennox.
And where's she from?
She's from Aberdeen. Aberdeen. And this actual track was the cover for the movie The Net, when it came out years ago. And yes, but Annie Lennox is one of my favourite singers, you know.
And you listen to it over and over again.
If anybody who knows me, when I find a track, I listen to it till it's dead, you know, I wear the track out, but never mind.
And you know every nuance, every phrase, every pause.
Yeah. That's it. That's my favourite track.
You're on Orange Ribbon, Joy 94.9 Multicultural Show, and we have Hugh today, our guest, and we talked about Shetland earlier. The islanders weren't actually that friendly to people who move into the island.
Some of them were friendly, but they called us Sousmuthers.
What's that? Which?
Sousmuthers. It means you speak with an accent from the south, from the mainland. Sousmuthers.
Sous being south, presumably.
Yes. Right. And muthers mean mouth, you see.
Ah.
It makes sense now, doesn't it?
South mouthers.
And so they sort of treated us a little bit different. You were never part of the community. Even I lived there for 3.5 years, and until the day I left, I was still classed as a Sousmuther. And it took me 6 months to learn what they were saying to me, because they have their own dialect up there. And it's what they call, it's a mixture of Norwegian and old Scots. And it's like a different language, basically. And it took me 6 months to learn what they were saying to me.
That's pretty quick for 6 months' time to pick up a dialect.
Well, you have to, because you're living there, and you're there every day, you know, 7 days a week.
What sort of population are we talking about? Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands,
a few thousands, maybe 10,000, 20,000, something like that. But when I was there, we had 4,000 construction workers.
All brought in from the mainland?
Yes. They lived in camps, and they were building Sulvo oil terminal. So the population then was huge, and you had all the other associated companies with building the oil terminal. So it was, 50,000 or something like that people. You know, it was huge.
So did the islanders actually speak freely about you, because thinking that you didn't understand?
I don't know if they did that, because for the first 6 months I didn't understand them. But once I learned their sort of dialect, I suppose you could call it, I decided that I found out that most of them can speak English the way we speak in Scotland. But because we came from the mainland, we refused to speak it. So when I learned their dialect, I refused to speak it. So they'd speak to me in their dialect and I'd return it in the way I speak it at the moment, in English. So I never ever spoke it. I can speak it a little bit, but I never ever spoke it. I just understood it. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit different.
So after you were saying in the break that you went back to, not Aberdeen, Edinburgh, was it?
After I left Shetland, I went to Aberdeen for 18 months. I lived there. And then I moved back to Edinburgh, yeah. And
why?
Because of my job again. Because working in hospitality, you do move around. And if you get an opportunity of a good position, then you have to move with it. So I moved to Shetland, moved to Aberdeen because of my job, and then I got the chance of a really good job back in Edinburgh. And it was where I originally came from, so I decided, yeah, let's go back to Edinburgh.
So by now, are you a fairly out gay boy by now? Or
Aberdeen, I started to, because up until... I'd been with my first boyfriend for 3.5 years, but we lived in Shetland, so there was nothing there, so you couldn't really be out.
So did you live together on Shetland, or it was kept very discreet?
Kept very discreet, because, as I said earlier, we lived in accommodation that the hotel provided, so I actually opted for a hotel room, and so did he. So we had two hotel bedrooms across the corridor from each other.
So they weren't both used... on the same night,
sometimes,
usually.
Sometimes. I've had an argument. It was really good.
This is Orange Ribbon, and you're with Alan and Kafam, and we're talking to our guest and co-host, Hugh, tonight.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
The very sexy-sounding Kaz Ms. Mitchell on Joy 94.9 Orange. I guess Hugh.
And Hugh, who's one of our co-presenters, but we've got him in the limelight tonight because at rather short notice, we've got to say, as I pointed out at the top of the program, because our scheduled guest unfortunately took ill at the last moment, so we hope to have him back at some later stage. Thanks to Terry from Eastern Kilda, who said he's enjoying the chat. Wants to know, well, he's saying that you sound cute.
Oh, thanks,
Hugh.
Terry.
Oh. by the way, Terry, Hugh wants to know how old
you are. So another phone call, Terry, to maybe fix up a date.
Excuse me, you weren't supposed to say that.
Anyway.
Now, talking about your accent, because, you know, the Scottish accent is quite attractive to a lot of people. And you were just telling us while off air that when you were in America, you got a lot of free drinks. Free things and drinks.
I don't think we were supposed to talk about this.
Yeah, tell us about
that. We did. Actually, I went to America with my first boyfriend, and we used to go out. And we were in Connecticut, and we went to the movies one night, and we were sitting in this movie house, and they actually served you drinks and foods in the movie house. And then we went into the bar next door, and it was fairly quiet. And the barman, who came from Los Angeles, actually, liked our accent. And we sat there talking to him all night and drinking. And at the end of the night, we said, oh, how much do we owe you? And he went, don't be silly, go, go, go. And that sort of happened a lot to us because of the Scottish accent. And I mean, I went to buy a suit once, and the tailor's wife was Scottish or something. And he made us come back the next day, you know, and to pick up the suit. And when we went back, they had a whole buffet table in the shop.
Goodness.
And they had wine and champagne and food. And all the family were there. And it was like, oh, my God, I only went to pick up my suit.
This is obviously, must have been quite a few, very few Scottish people there. That's why it was such a special occasion to run into another Scot.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. They just like the accent, I don't know.
Well, talking about New York, and there's a lot of Irish Catholics in New York, amongst other places. Mm. You come from a Catholic background yourself. What sort of an upbringing did you have? Was it a fairly religious family that you had growing up?
I went to Catholic schools. Church was mandatory every week, and also sometimes during the week. Prayed at school all day long, you know. We had some nuns and priests who taught at our school as well. So, and the household obviously was very, very, very Catholic. You know, my parents were, my father was a very strict Catholic. He was brought up by my grandfather, who was the type of person he didn't like people who drank alcohol or smoked or anything like that. You didn't do anything like that. So my father was a bit like that as well.
And did he make you do the rosaries every day as well? Was it part of the routine being a Catholic?
No, it was. You didn't do it every day, but you had to go to church quite a lot. Every Sunday, for example, you had to go to church. You could not miss church.
And if you did?
It just wasn't done.
Yeah, my father would lecture you for so long. You think, my God, I should have went to church. That, you know, the church sermon is shorter than this lecture. You know, so
why do I get the impression that you've stopped in later years, and how did that come about?
I actually continued going to church after I left the house until I was about 24. When I actually went to Shetland, I probably stopped. I did occasionally go, like Easter or Christmas, different times like that. But I moved away from the church because being gay and realizing I was gay and coming out, and the church doesn't really do, I don't think so anyway, this is my opinion. I don't think they do much for the gay community. If anything, they down us all the time. We're not made to feel welcome in the Catholic Church. And being gay and realizing I was gay and having a partner, I thought, well, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to go somewhere where I'm not really welcome?
And so you're growing up, you had this spiritual side to you. Now, when you turned, so to speak, turn your back onto on the church, there must have been a void that you wanted to fill, surely, a spiritual void?
Not really, no. Because I still believe in what I believe, and I still have the teachings that I had when I was growing up. But I just feel that I don't have to go inside a church to still believe what I believe. I can still believe in God. I don't have to go and kneel there for an hour every Sunday to prove that I'm a Catholic or I'm a Christian. I probably can't really say I'm a Catholic now. I'm probably excommunicated a long time ago. But, you know, I suppose in the end it was really to keep my parents happy that I would go to church. They'd phone me up and say, have you been to church? At Christmas, have you been to church? You know, and I suppose they've still got, you know, well, my mother still has her beliefs and believes in the Catholic Church and believes in everything that they teach. So, and I'm not going to disappoint her and go against her.
You have two sisters, I think you said, two older sisters. Where do they sit? Have they maintained their church connections?
Well, they're probably similar to me, actually. They no longer go to the church. They've got nothing against the church, but one of them married outside the church, so that didn't help.
Was that a taboo?
Yes.
In the early days, it certainly was. Yes. It's not quite so frowned upon these days.
She's my older sister, and she married when I was 12 years old. And then at that time, she decided to marry her fiancé, and they decided to get married in the Church of Scotland.
Which is the equivalent of a Church of England, isn't it? Sort of,
well,
isn't it?
Church of Scotland's further away from the Catholic Church than the Church of England is.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
So their teachings are. So she got married in the Church of Scotland.
And your parents attended the wedding?
We actually couldn't attend the wedding because it was during Lent. And
what's Lent?
It's just before Easter. And the bishop, we had to get permission from the bishop to attend the Church of Scotland, and he refused permission.
Goodness.
So we were at the wedding, we just couldn't go into the church. And because my parents were very, very strong Catholics and believed in everything and would not go against the church, their decision was that they had to go along with what the bishop said. So,
wow.
Now, let's talk about your, you know, being a presenter and being a volunteer at Joy. I am aware that at one stage you actually thought you could never be a presenter because you were a bit scared.
Yeah, well, I came to Joy because I wanted to get involved in some gay organization. I didn't really know what. And one day I was listening to Joy, and they were looking for volunteers for the front desk. And I applied, and eventually Rebecca interviewed me. And said, oh, we'd love you to come along. So I started doing the front desk. And I was very, very happy. Every Sunday, coming in between 11 and 1 and helping Allegro Non Troppo and Adam and Peter. And another presenter on Joy got into a bit of a fix one week with his show. And he's sitting across the desk from me at the moment, Kafam. And he phoned me in a panic and said, I'm doing a show today and my co-presenter's sick and I need to do the show. And you were doing a show on Spain.
On Spain, yes. And because you have travelled to Spain many times.
Yes. Well, you must come and help me. So that's how I ended up doing a show on Joy. And we did the show with Andy Mack. And it was good. It was quite good, you know. And at first I thought, I really don't want to do this because a lot of people were telling me I didn't know what I was talking about. We were talking about CGs in Spain.
Talking about what?
CGs. It's the gay
It's a village in Spain that is very gay. And obviously, the time I'd been there and the time that this other person
was in the 30s
had changed slightly, and they were saying, oh, you're talking rubbish, and I'm going, oh God, I don't want to do this again. But a few weeks later, we ended up doing a Scottish show, Kafam and myself, and it was quite good, you know, and it was a little bit better, and I enjoyed it. And then I was quite happy just going along and doing the front desk and helping Allegro Non Troppo, and then a position came up on Driven, and I spoke to Mr. Alan Smales, who's sitting across the desk from me.
Me? Was it me?
And ended up on Driven, which I've never regretted. It's really been good.
I felt, if I remember, about November, December 2007, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Somewhere about there. So why do you continue to do it now? You've got used to it. And
yeah, I enjoy coming in to Joy. That sounds a bit funny, that, didn't it? But I do enjoy coming here. I come every Sunday and help Allegro Non Troppo. And I feel part of a family, basically. It's you walk in the door, everyone's so nice to each other. You don't feel that you're working. You don't feel that you're coming in to do a job. You are doing a job. You're sitting at a desk and you're answering the phone and you're doing admin and everything else, but it doesn't feel like work.
But you actually wear four hats at Joy. Different hats.
I do the front desk on a Sunday. I look after the volunteer roster.
That's a huge roster, wouldn't it?
It keeps us busy. It keeps us busy because all the volunteers who are involved with the front desk are on that roster, and obviously they're volunteers, so, you know, there's a lot of people involved with it, so I look after that and update that on a sometimes fortnightly or monthly basis. And I do Orange Ribbon as a presenter, so that's three. I don't know who the four is.
You train?
Oh, I'm a trainer as well.
Too many hats.
Yeah, I train new people who come in. So if you, the listener, come to us and want to join us, then you're allocated to a trainer for, I think it's about 5 weeks now. So I've just finished training somebody just last Sunday.
And on the matter of training and related issues, we should point out too that if you come from a multicultural background, that is a non-traditional Anglo-Australian background, or your family does, and you think you'd like to have a chat to us on Orange Ribbon, we would love to hear from you. Drop us a line at orangeribbon@joy.org.au. Who knows, you might even end up like you and end up being part of the team. You never know.
I mean,
we're always on the lookout, and particularly for lesbians from a multicultural background.
Yeah. Yes, we don't do enough girls, do we?
No, we don't, so to speak.
And if you want to pop in on a Sunday between 11 and 1 and speak to me, because I'm always on the front desk, and you are interested, then I'm happy to sit down and talk to you as well.
Okay, Hugh, well, it's been interesting having a chat to you again.
Yes, and I hope you know a lot more about Hugh now.
Too much, maybe.
Thanks, anyway, Hugh, for filling in at the last minute when, unfortunately, Tony was ill.
And hopefully, Tony, you're feeling better and your boyfriend's looking after you.
And maybe we'll speak to you again in a week or two's time if you're getting better.
And thank you, Nick, at the front desk for looking after us, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And from all of us, good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.